No one plans for hair loss, but through Hims, you can take the next step with confidence. Access treatments made with clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil to stop hair loss and regrow hair in 3 to 6 months. No waiting rooms, no hoops, just ingredients with a track record of results. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you, with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put your goals first. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your free online visit. hims.com/Hail Mary. Individual results may vary, based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Welcome to a special bonus edition of the Sports Media Watch podcast. I'm John Lewis, and in today's episode, I'm joined by Brian Goski of VideoAmp in a discussion about ratings, measurement, and much more. We get into the big data question, a lot of talk about out-of-home viewing. It's a discussion for aficionados, people who really know and are interested in television ratings and measurement. I know it's not going to be for everybody, but I hope that if you aren't necessarily big into TV ratings, obviously you're probably not listening to this podcast anyway. Why don't we just get right to it? Well, we have a special guest today. Brian Goski of VideoAmp is here, and VideoAmp is one of many measurement companies out there. I know we only really typically ever talk about Nielsen when we're talking about sports viewership, but there's a lot of companies that are out there measuring, viewing and with metrics that are not necessarily identical, obviously, to the average minute audience we talk about with Nielsen, but certainly can be edifying in their own way. So, Brian, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
John, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah. Why don't we just, for my listeners, I'm sure a lot of them are not familiar with VideoAmp. So why don't you just give a little bit of background on what VideoAmp is about, what it's doing, what it measures, and how it kind of differs from the established kind of Nielsen-based measurements?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. That's a great question, great lead-in. So, you know, VideoAmp was established, really. It's probably good to just start there because we felt as if measurement of the space wasn't providing media owners the value they really deserved in the marketplace. And so when our founder created VideoAmp, you know, he said, there's a better way to do this. We have a lot of great technology out there. We don't have to, you know, rest on what has been done over the past 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 plus years because of the technology that exists. Let's make a better way, and let's give the credit and value that media owners and advertisers deserve to their respective advertising and media that they provide to the ecosystem. So that's really sort of our come from, you know, in terms of how we build out our products and services into the marketplace. What we do is we're a big data-led company, meaning that we bring large volumes of viewership data for content and ad measurement purposes, as well as outcome-based purposes, to the marketplace for a variety of verticals. Sports is one of them, absolutely, especially in the emergence and change of media as it's happened over the past couple years. We accelerate all of this via technologies that are unique and different in the marketplace, like patented clean room technologies that we bring to market that allow us to pass large data sets between media owners to be able to look at everything from a census level. You know, what makes us a little different than others in the marketplace is a few things. So one is we are really a big data first company. So we're led by big data and then informed by some other pieces of data to calibrate what we bring to market. We believe today that the data sets exist to be able to measure at that level. And so we should lead with that level. That's a big differentiator for the between us and others in the market. Number two is really like, how do we bring it all together, right? And we bring it all together via things like patented clean room technology that we've accelerated into the marketplace that allow us to tie data sets together in ways that are at scale, but also extraordinarily efficient. So they're not super expensive for the media for the measurement company, but provide great benefit for the media company or advertiser or agency, you know, whomever we're working with at the end of the day. And that's real important, right? Because today, as we know, whether it's media measurement or anything else that's out there, there are voluminous amounts of data that are flying sort of all over the place. The ability to harness that and digest it in a way that provides output that is useful for the end client is a very difficult skill. You know, it's easy to, in other words, to get lost in the big data of it all. But we digest it down in a way that doesn't break our personal bank, you know, allows us to run a business and provide census level measurement and great outputs for our clients.
Can we like circle back a little bit? You know, we hear the term big data used a lot. Obviously, Nielsen is going to be bringing out their big data at the end of the year, making that their currency. Can you kind of break down for the listener who just has no idea at all, kind of, you know, what big data means for VideoAmp and what it means broadly as well?
So the question really is, what is big data? Because people talk about that all the time, and it's really not mysterious at all, right? Big data just means in today's world, whether it be media measurement or whether it's linear viewership or digital attribution or, you know, really, you know, patient records, whatever it is, there's an opportunity today for companies to have access to, in many respects, large amounts of data. And historically, what, you know, human beings have done when they've done measurement of anything is we've taken a sample set, a representative sample set. We've said, okay, you know, it's we can't measure everybody. So what we're going to measure is 0.05% of the population or 0.02% of the population, even in some cases. And then we're going to effectively extrapolate or make a guess as to how that viewership would be reflected into the entire population. The reality of today is that big data sets, meaning that in some cases, 100% of that data of the population is accessible in some way. And if you can gain access to it, you can provide as perfect measurement as possible. Meaning if you look at 100% of all of the data, it's better than having 0.02% of the data because there's going to be a margin of error between, you know, that 99% and the sub 1% that you have. So those big data repositories are actually accessible today. You can access them in many respects. Now, the trick is accessing it in a way that makes the holder of that data comfortable. So in many cases, you can't just send big data over the wall in an email because there could be sensitive information in the data. There could be pieces of the data that particular company that holds it doesn't want the other party to have access to for whatever reason. There's a variety of them. So the way to do that, there are technologies that exist like clean rooms that allow you to access data in a way that is that still gets you what you need from a measurement company perspective in our case, but also allows the data holder on the other side holding this voluminous amount of data, the big data, the protections they need internally so that they're not exposing anything that they don't want to. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So when you talk about these big data sets, can you go into detail about what those might entail and how those might relate to something like sports measurement?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 100%. So let's look at today. You know, a lot of viewership, I think we would all agree, is streaming. You know, it's not a secret. Amazon has picked up TNF. And NBC Universal has Sunday Night Football. Paramount has NFL. And those viewership events are shown not only on linear only TV, meaning you know, like the set top box you've had traditionally, or even, you know, the TV with rabbit ears, you know, some that a lot of people still have, still at, you know, 15%+ of the population, depending on who you ask, has at least you know, rabbit ears. And then there's a streaming component, as we all know. So Peacock carries it in some cases, for example. Paramount Plus streams soccer. Amazon streams Thursday Night Football. We all know that. So that data, the viewership for a specific event may live in several places. There might be a subsection of the population that watches football on Sunday via set-top box. Another part of the population might look at it via OTA or over the air, the rabbit ears. And then another part of the population might watch it on Peacock, you know, on Sunday nights. So the question is, how do you take all of that data, deduplicate it in a large data format? Because again, there's voluminous amounts of set-top box data, then streaming data, and you know, otherwise. How do you bring that all together to create, let's say, content viewership of that single event? So that's really, because you're asking really about the application of big data. So, you know, how do we use it in sporting events? That's a prime example. We may have a big population that streams it on Peacock, but is also watching it on NBC broadcast, or they're watching it on ESPN, you know, linear television, traditional television. And then another part of the population is watching it on the ESPN app or, you know, the Disney Plus app if they're able to access it via that. So you take all of that big data and you can bring it together to create, let's say, a single viewership event of a single game, in many cases against a single audience. Because eventually what folks want to know is, once we know how many people have actually watched the game, you know, we count the game, we say, you know, there's 29 million people that tuned in for a particular event, whether that's NFL, MLB, whatever it is. Who actually watched it? You know, is our viewership changing? Do we have an older skew, a younger skew? Is there any kind of ethnicity break that we should be aware of? Is it skewing, you know, more Hispanic than not, for example? What are the income breaks? You know, do people, you know, that make less than 50K a year, are they really our watchers? Or people that are 250K plus, are they our watchers? Usually it's a spread of some of those. It's a combination of all. So how do we understand our audience in that regard? And so that's really like the application of big data as it stands today.
Is there a circumstance where big data is leaving out anybody in terms of viewership? I mean, obviously set-top boxes, that's trackable data. Mm-hmm. All the streaming services, that's trackable data. Mm-hmm. But there are still people out there with a 2004 Zenith TV. Yeah. And, you know, they're not connected to anything. So are those folks, I mean, they would necessarily have to be left out, right?
Yeah. So they're not necessarily left out. So what measurement companies like us do is we correct for that. So, and that's the rabbit ears I was talking about before. There's actually a subset of the population, and it's arguable the number. We litigate this, you know, all the time internally, of course. Anywhere between, let's say, 15% or 22% of the population has what's called OTA, which is over the air. And that means they have a regular old television with rabbit ears on it. That's still, you know, that's free television, right? You don't have to pay anything. You can go out there, you can buy an antenna from Amazon even for $10 and get a lot of channels for free. You don't have to pay for it. But some folks have an old Zenith television. They just never traded it in, so they have it. So what we do is we actually use sources of information when we're doing our modeling and projection to bias correct against those circumstances. And there are not just that circumstance, but others that we have to correct for as well.
That's interesting, because I would imagine that some of those over-the-air folks are still trackable because they have smart TVs, right? And, you know, and like, for example, I have a smart TV, I have an antenna. When I'm watching something with the antenna, I know that the smart TV is still able to detect the programming. I mean, it has its own, you know, when you're setting it up, the digital channels, it has that ability. So out of the percentage, I'm curious if you might know this from your modeling, mm-hmm. What percentage are we talking about that is completely cut off? They don't have a smart TV. They don't have any smart tracking at all. It's just old school TV. What percentage are we looking at?
You know, I don't know that exact number. It's a great question. What I do know is the OTA number is roughly, again, between 15 and 22%, depending on, you know, what estimates are. And what to do our measurement, our portion of that measurement, we'll work with outside vendors. So we worked with the ARF Dash study, for example. It's a, you know, industry body that goes out and surveys a number of folks, and they say, hey, how many people have, you know, rabbit ears television versus cable versus streaming only? Because the industry grapples with this question all the time. And we get calibration information to be able to pull in and say, hey, you know what? The Dash study says, again, anywhere between 15 and 22%, depending on the age, the gender, the ethnic break, what part of the country they live in, et cetera. There are other things, too, that you have to model for. Not in our case, we don't model for it. We actually impute it because we bring the data in. But there are a lot of folks that are satellite, right? You still have Dish. You still have DirecTV. Those folks are out there. And typically, those folks are a little more rural. You know, not everyone lives in a city center. There are a lot of folks that live in rural America. And we want to account for those folks, too. We want to make sure that they're part of the model. So all of those little pieces, that's why companies like us exist. And that's why it's really hard for companies to enter the market, is because it's very difficult to pull all these pieces together and make sense of that big data, for lack of a better term.
You know, kind of switch gears a little bit. One of the big advantages that Nielsen has had all these years is the sample, mm-hmm. right? And the ability to have these Nielsen families where you can know exactly what demographic, age, you know, gender, race, and you know exactly who is watching and for whatever length of time. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that with big data, you don't have that level of granularity. Is that right?
It's actually not exactly correct. So there are ways to append external data sets to big data to impute some of that information. And also remember, you know, within the panel world, and we've looked at a lot of panels as well, you know, from the video perspective, and it's in some cases we work with some of them. There are inherent biases to panels too, right? Not all panelists are representative of the United States population. So there's inherent skew in even that data source. But to go back to your original question, there are ways to get at demographic information, buyer information. So in the end, you know, what do a lot of advertisers want to look at? They want to look at whether, you know, when you're watching the Super Bowl and you saw the Ford ad, did you buy a Ford? Did it influence your decision at some point? Did you buy more, I don't know, Taco Bell as a result of seeing the ad on the big game? Was that important to you? So there are ways to add those flavors of information to big data sets to get at things like demographics, buyer behavior, and other, you know, important information that our advertiser and content parties want to look at.
You make a great point about the biases of the panel. If I recall correctly, I'm not going to look it up right now because we're in the middle of a conversation, but I recall Fox, which it might surprise some people to know it was Fox, complaining a lot about Nielsen not having enough, you know, African-American panelists and kind of omitting that demographic in some ways. But of course, even with its shortcomings, one of the great selling points to advertisers is, hey, we have all of this, you know, we know exactly who we know exactly. My question in terms of big data, can big data get to that point where, you know, obviously right now it's kind of piecing together all these data sets, but 15, 20 years into the future, will you be able to have the exact, you know, the 100%, I know exactly who was watching for how long and who they were in the room with? Is that coming?
So I always say measurement's never exact. So to think that we'll ever get to 100% perfect measurement, any measurement company is a fool's errand, right? It's never going to happen. And one of the reasons why that is, and I always like to say, measurement companies are one step behind all of the media companies. We will never be ahead of them. And why is that, right? Look at the past 20 years of media consumption. In 2006, the first iPhone came out. If anyone can remember that, I'm old enough to remember that. That really changed viewership as we know today, right? You can now take the bus on your way to work and you can watch the game from last night on ESPN as a rewind because you have the app. So all of that, it means to say that measurement companies are just behind those types of technological shifts and changes and will never be 100% correct. In many ways, we don't want to get down to the individual level either, because there's a lot of privacy concerns when you think of things like COPPA, you know, the California Online Protection Act, or Child Online Protection Act, sorry. You want to make sure that you control for those things. We don't want to expose child viewership in a way that would hurt in any way, you know, minors, for example, anything like that. We want to make sure that we are adhering to state laws and those types of things. So you never necessarily want to get down to the individual viewership level. But viewership in aggregate is really what advertisers and what brands need. So they and exposure data. So they want to say, hey, broadly speaking, for the Hispanic audience that's 18 to 34, what are they watching? Can you guys get me to that level? If you can just get there, that's great, because I know my advertiser is really interested in that audience. They have a high income right now. We want to make sure that they're going to drive more of our product off the shelf, and we want to be able to find them. And if we know that Paramount, Televisa Univision, Telemundo have those audiences, and some of that is inherent, right, just based on the programming, but just to verify it, if you guys can get us down to that level, then we can map not only content and programming, making sure we're making the right programming for the right audience. Do we, for example, create programming for an older Televisa Univision audience or a younger one? And also, do we, target them with our product, whatever that product is? And should we change the ad format for that particular audience because they're a younger demographic versus an older demographic? So that's really like the spirit behind it. Again, the individual level, we're not really trying to get after. It's a landmine that we don't want to go after. But being able to provide broader based viewership and ad reporting is really what advertisers and content owners want to see.
Kind of going off of that same conversation about privacy, and one of the biggest sources of viewership right now that isn't being measured is illegal streaming, right? Mm. I think we all know, I've taught classes before, I asked the students to raise their hands if they stream sports illegally, and pretty much every hand goes up, because these kids did not grow up when Napster was happening and people were getting busted in their dorm rooms for downloading music, right?
I had Napster, full disclosure, when it first came out. I also downloaded it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the interesting thing is this generation of kids, they just have no compunction whatsoever about watching sports illegally.
Yeah.
And obviously that viewership is not being tracked in any official source. Is there any universe where big data would incorporate that kind of viewership?
There's a way for you to use big data to understand that viewership if you had access to it. For big data, it's all about getting access to the source of the information. So if there's a new Napster app or something like that, it could live within an operating system, an OS, and the OS may have access to that data and then share it, usually not with someone like us, but they'd probably share it with the FBI or something like that. But there are ways to get at that data, even if it's encrypted, and share it with the appropriate, parties. Yeah.
That would be an interesting one, because the reality is, in a lot of cases, they're still watching the ads.
Yeah.
Right. If you're illegally streaming ESPN, you're still seeing the advertising for it.
Yeah. And in some ways, let's boil it down to advertising, and it's good to be very specific in measurement, because measurement has a number of rabbit holes when you start to really tie it down. And if you bucket it into two like main things, right, content, and those are content owners like a Paramount, NBC Universal, even an Amazon, that own content, that produce content in studio or film it like a live sporting event and bring it to market via a platform. That's sort of the one bucket. And then bucket number two is advertising. So within those big content buckets that create billions of dollars of revenue for those respective organizations, there's advertising that kind of fits in as a piece of additional revenue within them, right? They're not big ad networks, in other words. They're big content companies that happen to sell ads on the side in some ways. There are ways via the ad server on the advertising side to identify where an ad shows up. And oftentimes, I suspect that oftentimes that's hidden, because sometimes, advertising revenue is a very good thing for companies. And so maybe they don't want to necessarily expose the fact, like if you're a big DSP and you might be buying in areas that maybe you shouldn't be, but you're making a couple billion dollars off of it, you may not want to expose that as much. All that said, the ad server could probably track that down, and then you could use fraud companies like an IAS or someone like that to understand where it actually lands.
Very interesting stuff. Let's shift a little bit and talk about the status quo. Obviously, I've been writing about television ratings for about 20 years on SMW. I write about it on a fairly daily basis. it's difficult when you're writing about a subject like that so often to always include the maximum level of context, the maximum level of, you know, I mean, for example, communicating to readers that these are Nielsen estimates. It's an estimate from one company, not an exact figure, because I think a lot of people, and, you know, Nielsen kind of contributes to this by putting out numbers that are very exact, right? 1,210,083, right? Yeah. And so a lot of people get the impression this is exactly the number.
Yeah.
As an observer and someone who's in the business, what would you like to see ratings reporting communicate to the audience?
So ratings reporting is really an, and to you, you know, to go back to your example, ratings reporting is really an estimate of who viewed that particular piece of content or ad. And so it's for the for viewers or folks that are curious about measurement or ask the question, really understanding that is very, very key. It's oftentimes not that exact number, but it's the best estimate that the measurement company can come up with in the marketplace for that particular piece of data. Now, when you talk about that particular piece of data, you know, I like to think about it, if I was to really boil it down simply, as a very simple problem of addition. You know, if we were to think about 2 + 2 = 4, 4 is the output, right? So then the question is, well, is it 4 - 0? Is it 2 + 2? Is it 3 + 1? What does the equation look like to get to that 4? That's really like the meat of all of this. So for viewers to understand that there's a lot that goes into that first piece is extremely important. And oftentimes what you find when you live in this world a little bit is there are a lot of missing pieces in that first portion that someone doesn't account for, or maybe they don't account for it as good as you think they did, or maybe they could be over or severely underestimating a particular audience. Use local, for example. You know, historically, local reporting was based on very small samples, but that's not necessary anymore. You can have very voluminous amounts of local viewership data. Local's a huge, local and a regional sporting events are huge. It's big business, right? And big viewership. And so making sure that you account for all of that in the equation at, in a big data format is super important. So I guess, you know, answering your original question, for the curious audience, them understanding how that sausage is made and how that output is created is super important.
No one plans for hair loss, but through Hims, you can take the next step with confidence. Access treatments made with clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil to stop hair loss and regrow hair in 3 to 6 months. No waiting rooms, no hoops, just ingredients with a track record of results. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put your goals first. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your free online visit. hims.com/Hail Mary. Individual results may vary. Based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
To the example before, you know, talking about the Nielsen panel, and there are obvious advantages to the panel, but then there are also kind of vulnerabilities to the panel. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking specifically about out-of-home viewing. Mm-hmm. Out-of-home viewing comes in 2016 and becomes part of the currency in 2020. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we see every change in out-of-home viewing, every increase in the way that's measured, the numbers, you'll notice, I mean, obviously, suddenly all the viewership is really good across the board. All the leagues that were having trouble in the fall, the NBA, the NHL, college basketball, they were having trouble in the fall. They're doing great right now.
Mm.
And I don't necessarily know how much of that. I mean, some of it is obviously viewing changes. The Luka LeBron situation in LA, you know, helps in the NBA. But I get the sense a lot of it is just Nielsen changed its methodology. I'll let you jump in.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if it's that. So, and I can't obviously speak about what Nielsen does just because they're best to, you know, comment on that. But I'll speak about this more broadly, you know, in the comment of all of a sudden, like the viewership got better. I don't know if that's actually true, right? What happened was the companies like ours, you know, like theirs and others are able to measure more because the data now exists, right? So let's use out-of-home as a great example. You know, out-of-home, VideoAmp's out-of-home product is also a big data approach. We have, millions and millions of televisions that we bring in from bars and restaurants that map back to our ID system that allow us to append that data to our in-home viewership. And previously, you would use small panel sets to be able to measure that. And sometimes people walk in a bar, sometimes people don't. So even of the small panel, maybe you get a piece of that. What happened was because of this sort of like big data explosion and access to this data, you're now actually able to, and this goes back to my opening mantra and why we created our company, we're able to give the media owners the value that they deserve for the content they're creating. So like, look, if I'm the NFL and I get a number that is in-home only, the first thing I would say is, well, hey, a lot of college kids are going to watch football in bars. We all know that. Everyone, you know, we've all gone to college. We gone to a college bar and watched a football game at one point or another. And we even know after college, there are a lot of Penn State bars around the town that I live in, for example. So, you know, there are folks that come in and they went to Penn State, even though they don't live in Pennsylvania anymore, and they watch the Penn State game. And people go watch the Super Bowl. People have Super Bowl parties all the time. They want to make sure that they're accounting for that viewership out of home. The viewership for out of home could be upwards of 15 to 20%. That's a huge amount of viewership. And now think about how that carries into the business, right? So when you're negotiating things like carriage deals, when you're negotiating advertising rights and all those things, if I was on the content owner side, I've been underserved. My media has been undervalued, and it's maybe undervalued for decades. And so think then if you're on that side of the game, you know, to use the term loosely, if you're on that side of the game, you start to look back historically. Well, what past 5 years? What's the revenue calculation? How much money have I lost as a result of that? If the data is either not there or it's wrong. So that's one piece. That's just out of home. Now let's talk about the shift of viewership to streaming. We talked about Amazon before. Amazon's got TNF. We know that. If you're the NFL, you want to understand is Amazon streaming part of this number? It should be part of the number because we know, you know, I've watched streaming games on Amazon, Thursday Night Football. I've watched them on Peacock on Sunday Night Football. So if you're one of those media owners, now you've gone to the NFL, you've done a contract with them, your Amazon, your NBC Universal, your Paramount, you've done a contract, you spent a lot of money on it to ensure your business longer term. And you want to make sure that you're looking at all viewership for that particular game, that particular week, that particular month, that particular season, and getting value for everything. Those are just two examples. That doesn't even count, let's say, mobile viewership, you know, stuff like that. That's all really important. So this is where having the legacy system is very, very difficult, right? Because viewership's been fragmented now more than ever. So big data, when passed in the appropriate way, allows you to account for all of that fragmentation of viewership and allows the media owners to truly get the value they deserve, which again, that's the goal of our company. That's why we come to work every day.
Can I dig in a little bit more on the out-of-home methodology? Because it's interesting. So the way that VideoAmp does it, the televisions themselves are transmitting data for your use. Am I right?
Yeah, there's ACR transaction or viewership that happens in bars. that we're able to access. And then we can use location data to precisely see when that individual was in the location when the game was on. Yeah.
Okay. I know that Nielsen and Tunity Analytics, which is, I assume no longer active, they have done out-of-home before using audio signals. Mm-hmm. In either case, I've always been trying to figure out since the beginning of out-of-home, how can you be sure who is watching what in a location where there's numerous TVs all tuned to something different?
That's a great point. And it's not an easy problem to solve. So what we do is we also overlay with things like surveys to make sure that we are asking the right questions to the right folks, and that they're watching that we can infer that they're watching the right content at the right time. It's measurement's not perfect, it's not 100% perfect. So you can never precisely know if someone is staring directly at the television. But the way that we approach it is we know that the individual's in the location while the game is on and may otherwise not be. And there's some data science that we put behind that and then overlay with some survey information to make sure that we sort of, let's say, for lack of a better term, double check the fact that they're there. But what doesn't happen with what we have is, you know, if there's an audio signal and you're listening for something on the TV and there are three or four TVs in the room, you're right, there could be some confusion. Right. So there could be massive confusion. Are they watching the Jetsons, you know, on this TV? I'm a child of the 80s, so I remember the Jetsons. Or are they watching the game? You know, which one are they actually watching? That's something that we don't have to contend with because of the methodology we employ.
What is the value of out-of-home viewing for advertisers? I've also kind of been curious about that because
Great question.
You're in the restaurant, the game goes to a break, you're eating, talking, all these other things.
Yeah. Oh gosh, the value of advertising is tremendous. So let me talk about it from a couple different angles. Yes, the advertiser point of view, but also the content creator point of view, and then also the league, you know, point of view. Right. So on from the advertiser point of view, they're going through a process wherein they're trying to target their viewer. So maybe you're that person's going to watch the Super Bowl in Buffalo Wild Wings, for example. But for whatever reason, Taco Bell wants to target that individual because they find a high correlation between Buffalo Wild Wings eaters and people that go to Taco Bell. And they want to, you know, get more of that cross-pollination of visitation and then ultimately revenue in the end, right? So that's number one. The advertiser gets a sense of where are our potential customers viewing a specific event? And can we reach them in that venue? That's really key. Advertisers are always trying to find where those individuals are so they can deliver their message to the appropriate person at the appropriate time, which ultimately will go back to more, milk off the shelf, so to speak. For the content creator, it's the same thing, right? They want to know, hey, if 15% of our viewership, maybe 20%, depending on the event, is in a particular bar or restaurant, well, we want to account for that. We want to make sure that advertising is accounted for when we put out not only our viewership numbers, but also our advertising numbers, meaning that for the Super Bowl, we want to make sure we account for that 15 or 20%, whatever the number is, right, that you estimate for that particular game. But then number two is, hey, I sold something into Wingstop. You know, like they bought on Paramount. They're part of our client base, and we want to make sure they're really happy. We don't want to give them 85% of the credit. We want to give them 100% of the credit and make sure that we're accounting for that out of home. So on the advertiser side, as well as the publisher side or content creator side. And then if you're on the NFL side, NFL or MLB or NHL, whomever it is, when, you know, let's say the content creator side or the league side, those folks also might want to know, you know, what's our viewership look like in the out of home venue? And also for that particular advertising, might be interesting for us to know if we're doing some, you know, league sponsorship of Wingstop for this particular event. Did they also go to out of home and watch that particular ad? So there's a couple different areas that come together in this particular arena.
Is there some out of home viewing that's more valuable than others? I mean, I would imagine restaurant and bar is different, certainly, than a hospital or an airport.
So that it's a trick question, John, because depending on who asked me that question, there's someone out there that thinks hospital viewership is immensely important, you know, and we all know, right? You go to a business, for example, and in some cases, you see an ad when you're going up the elevator. I've seen those, and those are targeted ads. So it really depends on the advertiser, right? I don't think we can say one is necessarily more important than another. It really depends on who you're trying to target, where you're trying to target them, and what the brand is, right? If you're a B2B company, you may really want to target someone in an elevator heading up to the 16th floor. But if you're Wingstop, you probably want to target someone in a bar or restaurant that's watching the game. So it all depends on the advertiser in the end.
Let's get back to kind of VideoAmp specifically. I know VideoAmp for most of the past year was basically the only game in town for Paramount. Paramount had its conflict with Nielsen. Obviously they ended up going back to Nielsen, but, for I think the Grammys, the VideoAmp number is what Paramount used in their publicity. Obviously, Nielsen has kind of become like Xerox, synonymous with measurement. As a challenger, what are you looking to do at VideoAmp to, one, make people aware that Nielsen is not the only game in town, and two, be able to be the company that networks go to, not when they're in conflict with Nielsen, but instead of?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. So, and you're correct that Paramount and VideoAmp, have a very long-term relationship. We announced, this is very public, so it's, nothing off the record or anything. We announced a very long-term relationship, three-year relationship with them coming into this year. We're very proud of it. They are also a challenger brand in market. What those folks have done, over the past couple months has been admirable. And what it does is it signaled to the market that the market is interested in change. The market is interested in alternatives, and alternatives are good, right? They're good because they spur innovation, they spur pricing normalization, they spur competition. All those things, in free market society, that's exactly what you want. You want products to get better, and so that's really important for us as a challenger brand. We've always been known as a challenger brand. It's in our ethos. It's in our culture at work. It's how we come to work every day. And what we want to really communicate to the ecosystem via that is there are better ways and more innovative ways to approach what we've done for decades. We believe we found what is, a better mousetrap, for lack of a better term. And it there's so many levels of how we do things differently in that you don't have to sort of rest on what we've done forever. Change is scary. It's difficult. What Paramount did was extremely difficult. There are others that are on the edge, I think, of doing something similar in the way of Paramount, really thinking about and actioning on new currencies in the marketplace, new measurement in the marketplace, because the industry, frankly, wants it. There's not one TV network, agency, brand that I've spoken to, and I lead commercial for both sides of our business, that I've said, we want less competition. Not one. Every single one is how can we work with you guys closer? How can we advance the ecosystem? How can we make sure we get value for our media? We measured, I think, the Golden Globes for Paramount. We measured a lot of Sunday Night Football for Paramount. We put out overnights for Paramount. So what we're trying to signal, again, through that spirit of innovation, that spirit, that challenger spirit, I think that only VideoAmp brings. Again, we've always been known for that. And I hope we always are known for that. That's in our ethos and our spirit, is that there is a better way to move forward. And no one should be afraid of trying it. It's there. You just have to give it a shot.
All right. Let's kind of close out a little bit talking about the future here. Right now, everything is kind of siloed in its own space. Television is in its own space, podcasts, YouTube videos. When are we going to get to the point, or are we going to get to the point where the NFL and the biggest podcasts
and, you know, Mr. Beast even,
are
all kind of being measured the same way and can be compared to each other?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. So the so when are we going to get to that point? Again, we stay one step behind the industry, as I like to say. There's content creators, you know, like you, like Paramount, like others, and then we do our best to catch up with you all as you're creating your content. And so as folks come to us and they say, hey, you know what? Podcasts are extraordinarily important. Can you please measure it? Can you include that in your measurement somehow? We say to agency, hey, agency, is that important to you as well? We try to match, you know, both sides of the business as the neutral arbiter that we are between buy and sell side, or agency and content creator. And if someone says, yes, that's extremely important to us, we find a way to bring it together. A piece of that, and an important piece, if you're measuring what I would refer to as fragmentation, which is really what you're describing, there's podcasts, there's digital video, there's Mr. Beast, there's all these different areas that people are consuming video right now, Instagram, Netflix, man, you can count them, right? And it's going to consolidate eventually a bit, but it's still very fragmented. What you have to do is make sure that when you're measuring all of it, you're measuring through some type of ID system, some type of ID spine, to make sure that if John watches, you know, the podcast or listens to the podcast, but then goes and watches the Super Bowl, you know, in the bar and sees a Wingstop ad, but then, you know, also goes home later and flips on a set-top box and finishes the game because he wasn't able to do it in the bar, that you're measuring that thread of individual through all of those experiences. And that's, again, where VideoAmp is very strong. We've built our system in a way that can thread through all of the fragmentation and distill it down to a household that we can view viewership and ad measurement against. That's hugely important. I like to say we've built the future. That's again, part of our challenger brand. We tend to think, you know, 2-3 years into the future, and I think we've built it.
That does kind of get to the panopticon problem, though, doesn't it? Like, I mean, you're, no matter where you are, no matter what you're doing, your, you know, Wingstop can know to reach you. So it kind of gets back to that privacy issue.
Yeah.
Is it at all possible to be able to bring all of this viewing into the same box without necessarily someone feeling like they're in the Truman Show?
I love that movie, by the way. I'm glad you referenced it. Yeah, it is. And that goes back to, you know, I would say this is like the creepiness of measurement, right? So you don't want to be intrusive. That's, and candidly, that's not really valuable. There are companies out there, if you dig a little deeper into the ecosystem, that get intrusive. And I'm mindful of those just because I live and breathe this every single day. That's not really VideoAmp's mission, right? We are not interested in getting down to that level. And in fact, that's why we have our clean room technology and go to market in a way that only allows us to pull out certain aggregates of information. So we'll only, you know, pull out from a database all males 18 to 49, all females 25 to 49. You know, we want to look at things in aggregate, because unless you are trying to hyper target an individual through a phone or something like that, through an ad ID, which you can do. There's, you know, UDIDs on phones and stuff like that, which are unique IDs for a particular phone, or ad IDs that live in phones. This happens all the time for anyone that plays a video game on their phone. You get retargeted constantly. That's not really our what we want to do. Like, what we want to do is measure at a macro scale and then use privacy-first technology that protects our users from any of that type of behavior. Because eventually, let's be serious, eventually, you know, the government will catch up in privacy, and the tech ecosystem tends to be a couple steps ahead of, you know, like the federal government level. But eventually that will catch up, and that kind of behavior will likely cease to exist. So what we're thinking about now is, hey, that's likely to happen, right? And at some point. So how do we do this in a very smart way that's user-centric, that's privacy-centric, but also allows our clients to get what they need and doesn't divulge an individual level record or anything like that? That's exactly why we built our company the way we did.
All right. And just, I probably should have asked you this at the top.
Sure.
Can you go into detail on the clean room technology?
Yeah. So clean rooms are talked about oftentimes in our industry, and I find that not a lot of folks totally understand, you know, what they are. So it's one of those terms that's thrown around a lot, like addressable, for example. So what clean rooms are really, in its essence, a way to access data that is that gives both sides of the equation equal treatment. And let me take it a level deeper. If we need to access data on, you know, from a client, I don't know, let's say it's Fox or somebody like that, you know, if we have to get access to their data, we don't necessarily want someone just to like email a bunch of data over, right? Because there are inherent privacy issues in a lot of that. If someone could forward that email to an external party, there could be sensitive information in that email that they don't want folks to have access to. So what clean rooms allow you to do is they allow you to access the data, let's say on Fox's home digital soil, for lack of a better term, and allows them to approve what's coming out of their soil to the measurement provider. So we may send over what's called a query. You know, we may it's an ask. A query is an ask. Hey, we want to see, you know, on your side for all the streaming properties, you know, viewership for males 18 to 49. Will you permission that? And there may be a party in Fox that says no. You know, that's not okay. We don't want to divulge that for a variety of reasons. So we're not going to allow you to access that. So all clean rooms do is sort of facilitate that exchange of data from one side to another in a way that make both sides comfortable.
If we were to get a picture of what all viewing is, yeah, right? Everyone is watching. Do you think that live sports and news would make up a greater percentage of that viewing today in 2025 than it did 40 years ago? In 1985, when you only had three networks and the options were limited?
I do. I think it does, especially, and it depends on the medium. You know, so if we're talking about set-top boxes, rabbit ears, we had that conversation before, but live news and sports, dominate a lot of viewership. And that's why they're so important to a lot of our partners. So I do think so.
You know, that's interesting, because my thought process is that it would be lower because there's so many different options, right? I mean, between the Mr. Beasts and the podcasts and, you know, the reruns.
Yeah.
I get the sense that a lot of these reruns are getting audiences that, you know, 40 years ago, people weren't binging I Love Lucy the way that they watched Friends. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. Maybe I'll backtrack a little bit. I guess for live, because they're live events, when you think about like live events, so I think like sports would make up the lion's share of live events, right? But yeah, you're correct in that of all viewership, of total viewership, it's probably a smaller percentage now that I think about it. But of live events, sports, you know, makes up the lion's share. So it depends on like the time frame of the viewership, I guess.
Yeah, certainly the case that there's just so many options now. I mean, we know that live sports and news does well because it's really some of the only stuff that is measured. But if you brought in everything.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. There's syndication. There's, you know, there's endless amounts of content.
I do get the sense, just from someone who covers the industry, I get the sense that maybe we're all overstating to an extent just how dominant sports has become, because a lot of people have left measurement.
Yeah, you know, yes and no, right? So dominant, when you think of, look, when you go to anyone's upfront events, and the whole industry is changing quickly, right? In a way that is seismic, it's tectonic in a lot of ways. That, you know, these big legacy structures are adjusting in real time. It's like watching a tanker turn into a speedboat in a matter of months. It's really fascinating to watch. All that said, when you go to any upfront event, and follow them this year too, right? The big headlines are sports. They always bring out the big headlines. Peyton Manning's coming out, or the Manning brothers coming out. You always have that that not edge, but that that point as part of their upfront event. And what's the upfront event? It's pitching. It's pitching the industry that, you know, that company is here to stay. That company has new and great content, really interesting. News and sports are big pieces of that. The entertainment piece, yeah, it's there for sure, but sports is a very big piece.
Absolutely. No argument there. very interesting conversation. I think we could go for another hour, but I'm going to go ahead and let you get back to your day. Thank you again for joining me. Would love to have you back on sometime.
John, thanks so much. Can't wait to come back.
Well, that was great. I hope you all enjoyed it. I know I certainly did. And again, you know, obviously this is a pretty nitty gritty conversation, gets into the minutiae of TV ratings, but the minutiae of TV ratings is what I've been covering for about 20 years now. All right. Well, thank you for listening to this special bonus edition of the pod, and we'll be back with more stuff next week.